Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 87. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. Quentin Tarantino is making a film, so we're talking about it. I feel like it's almost that simple, but I have J.R. Forresteros, Elijah Davidson. We have a great conversation. Tarantino films always almost give us too much to talk about because lots of his themes are right on the surface. So we get to talk about the stories that we tell because that is woven in inside and out of this Hateful Eight story. And I don't want to spoil too much, so I'll move on. And I move on by saying, please check out realworldtheology.com. We have new reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, podcasts, all kinds of stuff, and lots of brand new stuff that we're just now coming out with. Watch out for our moral dialogue dilemmas. We have a new podcast launching soon. You can be part of our discussion group on Facebook. You can follow the Twitter account at Real World Theo. Please subscribe to the podcast. Follow us in whatever way works best for you, whether it's on Stitcher, Feedburner, iTunes, wherever you are, please rate and review the show. I can't express that enough. It helps so much when you rate and review the show. So anyway, this is a really, really great show. We talk about lots of cool things. I promise. Here it is. Episode 87, The Hateful Eight. And the stories we tell.
It's gotta be hard to be someone of the greatest generation and go to Westerns for the last like 30 years, you know?
Yeah.
Because like they're not what you grew up watching at all.
No. No, they're all basically No Country for Old Men, like thematically. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know? Uh-huh. Where it's like, I'm getting too old for this. I quit the world. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what would draw you to The Hateful Eight, Elijah? Because I think you said that one of the reasons I was going to have you on is because you said something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but you were like, this is my Star Wars or something like that. You were getting dressed up. Like, is it Tarantino or was it this movie?
I said I'm posting on Twitter, Facebook, whatever, that this was my Star Wars. Only because it was like I look forward to a Tarantino movie the way most people look forward to like the new Star Wars movie. You know, like I think for some people, like Star Wars is everything that is fun about movies. You know, it epitomizes what is fun about movies and why you go to the movies and stuff. And for me, like Tarantino is one of those directors that is kind of the same thing, like. He is everything that's fun about movies for me. Even if I don't agree with him about a lot of things.
Wait, what do you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get there. But he loves movies so much. And his movies are they're all about the movies that he's watched before, you know? Mm-hmm. Like his movies are a celebration of certain kinds of movies. And so I just think it's tons of fun, you know? Like I avoided all trailers. I was mad that I saw a poster for The Hateful Eight in the theater. Like, I didn't want to know anything. I didn't want to know who was in it, like what it was about. Like, I knew it was a Western. Tarantino directed it, and there was snow involved. That's all I needed, you know? Like, I wanted nothing more.
Hey, Elijah. And,
yeah.
Did you – I assume then you heard about the script leak.
I heard about that a long time ago. And
yeah.
I saw like that as a headline. And then I just like made sure I didn't see any of that, like click on nothing. Like I want to know nothing about this thing before I see it. And I don't typically care about spoilers so much for most movies or whatever, because that's not why I watch movies. You know, like to be surprised by the narrative, really. Like I watch for reasons, but for something like this, it's the Coens are the same way. Like I haven't seen the trailer for Hail Caesar. I think maybe it's a musical. Like, I think I saw someone say something. That's all I know. That's all that's more than I want to know.
Well, it'll be up for a Golden Globe Best Musical or Comedy for sure.
Next year.
Yeah. So anyway, it's that kind of thing though. Like Tarantino is a filmmaker who loves movies so much, and I love movies a lot, and obviously, and so like it's fun for me to go see what he loves, you know. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I mean, so is it because of him kind of homaging to the things that he loves, or is it something specific that he does? Is it like a topic that he comes back to? Is it a style that he comes back to? Or is it just that you can tell that he loves movies?
He's always having so much fun. Like, that's what it comes down to for me. Like, his movies, you can tell that he is having fun. With the characters, with the kind of movie it is, everything. He's having a great time. And it's not like he's having a great time and, like, it's all kind of haphazard and whatever. Like, he's super thoughtful about it, know? Like, mm-hmm. like, everything is super intentional. And even, like, down to, like, what people are wearing and, like, how he shoots it and all that kind of stuff. He puts great intention into it, and that's fun for him, you know, to do it well. And that's just fun to watch. Like, even, like, as a lover of movies, that's fun to watch. Even if I don't like what he shows me sometimes, you know, like, even if the thought content is not something that I typically enjoy, you know, it's just fun that he's having so much fun and doing it so well. It's like, you know, you got like, truth, beauty, and what's the other one? I'm going blank right now. It's like beauty, you know, like there's an aspect of beauty to Tarantino's films just in the amount of intention he puts into it, mm-hmm. and the amount of fun he's having doing it. And that's just a fun world to enter into.
Yeah. I would say, even if it's something that I don't, or I'll make a sports metaphor on a movie podcast, because this is totally the audience, right? So even on sporting teams that I don't like, watching someone who was made to be like, who is the best at doing the thing that they do, even if I don't agree with the team that they're playing for, it's just sometimes fun to watch.
Yeah.
Someone do something that they put great time and effort and care into. Mm-hmm. And that seems like it's what you're saying, which is something I agree with too. Cause there's lots of things that I would go see just because I'm like, you know, if this person's in this, I know they're going to put everything into it. And I love watching them do what they do. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, totally. You know, like I would rather watch a bad movie this is an argument I have with filmmakers at Fuller all the time. I'll end up defending movies, kind of with The Good Dinosaur, actually. I think it kind of works the same way.
Jupiter Ascending?
Jupiter Ascending kind of works, too. The Wachowskis is the same way. Like, I would much rather watch a failure, you can see me, I'm doing air quotes, a failure of a film that has great ambition, where the filmmakers really cared what they were doing, than something that works, you know, pretty well, but that has no personality, that has no, there's no sense of fun to it. It's just kind of something like Age of Ultron, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, that was a movie that I didn't feel like anyone was having any fun in that movie at all. Like, everyone was just, like, grinding through that thing and getting it out there. It works for the most part, you know? Like, the movie itself works, but I leave the theater feeling heavy, thinking about the people who worked on it and what a terrible time they had doing it.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Which, by all accounts, is exactly how that movie went down.
Yeah, which is, I would say is probably
you can see it. Accurate. Yeah. You can see it on the screen. Yeah.
Okay, so then, JR, you know, same kind of question. What is it that brings you to The Hateful Eight? Is it The Hateful Eight, or is it Tarantino, or a combination of both? You know, kind of like, what are you expecting to get into?
Yeah, so I'm a mixed bag with Tarantino. You know, I really liked Reservoir Dogs, though I can only bring myself to watch it like once every 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. I didn't love a lot of his other stuff. I'm like the only film buff in the world that was underwhelmed by Pulp Fiction, which I know like loses me all of my film credibility, but I'm trying to be real.
Vulnerable!
You know, Kill Bill was fine. Again, like, I guess kind of whatever. But his more recent movies, I've actually found myself enjoying quite a bit more, particularly Django Unchained. And so I had heard before Django that he was working on a spaghetti western. So when Django came out, I thought that was it. And then I heard him say, my next one's going to be that spaghetti western I've been working. I was like, oh, okay. Well, I will reinstate my excitement then. Okay, great. And so, you know, then when the script leak happened and I understood when he said, you know, I'm not going to make it. I'm so furious. Like I really got that. Because again, not every filmmaker puts nearly the time and effort into a screenplay that Tarantino does.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understood that. I'm glad he decided to go ahead and make it. So even before the first trailer dropped, I was going to see it. Partly, as you said earlier, because I see most things. And I knew people, like, that's one of the things I like to see films people are talking about. Because I like to at least listen to the conversation if I don't participate in it. And I knew everyone talks about every Tarantino film. You know, he's one of the guaranteed films. So, I mean, even from that perspective, I was going to go see it. I saw it the first time. I saw just the regular cut. And then I went and saw the Roadshow again. And I enjoyed the Roadshow experience. It was a lot of fun. If anyone was able to go see it at Roadshow, I yeah.
Cause, sorry to interrupt. So I've only seen the Roadshow version.
Okay.
I did not see the other version or whatever. And from what I understand, the regular version, whatever, doesn't have the overture or the intermission. Is that correct?
Correct.
I cannot imagine this movie without the intermission.
I did not see it with an intermission.
It literally just cuts, and then all of a sudden you have a narrator who says, about 15 minutes later, you're like, okay, that's weird.
I cannot imagine. Like, that intermission, that moment, like, where that's cut, where that intermission is, like, that's, wow, okay.
It's so intense. You need a breath, yeah.
You do, yeah. You totally do, yeah. And it's, like, it's an interesting experience to sit for 10 minutes, whatever the intermission is, with what you just saw. And have nothing else to do with it but wait, you know? Like, that's an odd place to be in. Like,
yeah.
The conversations I had during the intermission with people were so much fun. You know, both times I saw it, it was so much fun.
Well, I saw it in a theater where I guess most people weren't aware that it was a Roadshow thing.
Okay.
Because one guy showed up 5 or 6 minutes into it, and the overture's happening or just about finished. And he looks back at me and he's like, hey, did it start already? And I was like, yeah. Like, shut up. Like, sit down. And he was like, no trailers. So I'm all, same dude.
Wait, so Mikey. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, then at the intermission and at the intermission break, there's an intermission that, you know, it comes up and there's music. And like 5 to 10 people said some version of is this real?
were they the same people that were surprised when Fellowship of the Ring ended? And they're like, what?
But then
it just ended.
Well, then get this, that same guy. So I don't, Mikey. It breaks right after the scene where Sam Jackson, Major Marquise Warren, convinces General Sandy Smithers to pick the gun up so he can kill him.
Yeah,
like that's where it breaks. So when it comes back is when it's Daisy has a secret and someone poisons the coffee.
Yeah.
So literally, no lie, that same dude that walked in the middle of the overture, he walks back in after the intermission, after the coffee is poisoned. Like, he did not know that the coffee was poisoned. So I wanted to move down next to him because, again, this is the second time I've seen it, right? I wanted to move down next to him when everyone started vomiting blood and being like, what's going on, bro? Like, what do you think this is all about?
Because that's how he would have said it.
You know? Yeah, I mean, I was like, what?
So
dude,
I've got,
I don't, okay.
I've got two questions real quick. Both for you, Mikey. So what are we doing about spoilers here? Like, how spoilery can we get?
No reason to not spoil things. I want to be able to kind of talk about everything. So
typically,
the conversation naturally eventually gets to spoilers, but just because of what we're talking about now, we might as well go ahead and spoil everything.
Yeah.
Almost everything in a Tarantino film is a spoiler. So
yeah, and for me, like, knowing anything would have been a spoiler before I saw the movie.
Yeah, so spoilers.
Yeah. Okay.
People listening.
Right. And my other question is for you, Mikey, because you've only seen the non-Roadshow version. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize. Because you're talking about, like, so the Roadshow was, like, the 70 millimeter, like, when people say they're going to see the 70. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So.
And it had, like, 6 extra minutes of footage.
Possibly. I wonder what they were.
Huh. It was just little snippets of dialogue, honestly. It was fun to see the Roadshow part second, because I was like, oh, that's a fun little extra gag or joke or aside or whatever, like, that I didn't remember. Okay.
So you saw the regular version first, JR?
Correct.
Okay. So gosh, I can't even imagine without the intermission.
Yeah,
so
that's the thing.
What does it feel like when all of a sudden Tarantino is talking to you in the middle of the movie?
Yeah, that was really weird. I was like, why do we suddenly have a narrator? And I remember hearing that he wanted to put it in theaters and then have an intermission because it's so long and have that feel. But I never knew that I found out right now that that 70 millimeter showing was with the intermission and stuff. I didn't think it was. I thought it was just, you know, kind of the essence of it, but they didn't, because, you know, people don't want to put intermissions in shows because they could be showing another movie at that time and making more money. I didn't actually know that.
I hate to beat this drum, but if you lived in Dallas, you could have seen the Roadshow.
No, we could see the Roadshow around here.
Probably not.
No, we could see it in Durham and Charlotte.
No, you probably should have had to move to Dallas.
You probably should have moved to Dallas. it is still a drive. It's not like, actually, the funny thing is, for us to get to a Roadshow here, driving, 50 miles away, is probably the exact same amount of time it would take you guys to get to wherever you saw the Roadshow at.
Almost certainly true.
Because you live in Dallas. It's probably like 5 miles away.
Everything takes longer when you have to ride a horse.
That's right. Because Texas. I'm sorry. Hashtag because Texas. So I didn't know there was an intermission. Or I didn't know they actually did the ones with the intermission. And it makes so much more sense now, because after we watched it, I remember I was talking with my wife, Laura, and she just kind of was like, I don't understand why we suddenly needed a narrator in the middle of the movie.
Uh-huh.
Wasn't that really weird? And I was like, yeah, but it's a Tarantino movie, and it kind of played like a stage play, so I can give it a pass because, you know, it's a Tarantino movie. I assume he was making some kind of very intentional choice that I just didn't understand, because, you know, we were sitting through it all in one one long viewing. So it didn't really bother me that much, but it did like raise a flag. Like, why is this happening suddenly? Like, after
so I think
what's going on.
I'm just sitting here trying to imagine what it would have been like to see it and not know that there was ever an intermission and just all of a sudden have a narrator, and what I would have thought, like, critically, like how I would have interpreted that.
Oh, you know, I was taken out of it. I was like, why are we having a narrator? What is going on? Huh? Yeah.
I think what I would have, like, if that had, so I saw it at a press screening first, and it was the Roadshow version, although a DCP, not the 70 millimeter, and then I saw it again in 70 millimeter. And I think what I would have, I think how I would have interpreted it if I had seen it at the press screening without the intermission and just that narrator all of a sudden, I think rather than saying it took me out of the movie, I think what I would have said is it adds a layer, like a narrative layer to the film that didn't exist prior to that, you know, like suddenly we have it, like adds another meta-ness to it where we have someone who's actually telling us this story very clearly. Like in, have y'all seen, the Kubrick film, Barry Lyndon? Have y'all seen Barry Lyndon?
No.
Nope.
Okay. So you should watch it sometime. It's super long like this, like this movie.
You're totally selling me on it.
Yeah, no, it's super interesting. It's all shot with natural light. It's gorgeous to look at. But it has there's at least 3 narrative layers to Barry Lyndon. There's a narrator, but there's also Kubrick. Like, the narrator is like part of the story, telling about this guy in the past. But the narrator said at some point in the past as well, talking about Lyndon further in the past. And then you have Kubrick on top of that. So there's points where the narrator is talking and the Kubrick just fades him out. Like, It's awesome. Like, it's one of my favorite moments in any movie is when Kubrick fades out the narrator in Barry Lyndon. It's like this extra layer of none of this matters, these stupid humans, you know? And having Tarantino pop in all of a sudden in that movie would have added a narrative layer to me, to that movie for me, that would have complicated it considerably.
No,
this is why I love Tarantino. This is why I love Tarantino, because he does stuff like this that makes me think about it like long after, and he's, yeah, anyway.
No, well, like I would say, kind of like JR put it, it did take me out of the film a little bit because I was fully engaged. Mm-hmm. But when it took me out...
Maybe it's supposed to take you out of the film. And, like, raise your level above it so you're thinking about the story that you're watching.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point. Yeah.
That's why it didn't... Like, even though I was taken... Or maybe I was taken aback. Maybe I wasn't necessarily taken completely out of it. But most of the dialogue, most of the way characters interacted with these long monologues, it reminded me, of, like I said, of watching a stage play.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't that odd to me if I'm watching a filmed stage play.
Mm-hmm.
That there would be a narrator at some point. Like, it didn't seem like it would be the weirdest thing I'd ever seen. Though, knowing that there was an intermission, and that would have been, like, the comeback from the intermission, it makes way more sense. But I would say it could have been a train wreck, I think, handled in other ways.
It actually, like, with the intermission, the narrator has less, like, meta-narrative power than without it. Because with the intermission, you're like, oh, they're just catching you up because you went out to the lobby and got some popcorn or something, and he's just catching you up. But without the intermission, it adds that layer. It does take you out a little bit. It makes you aware of the story that you're watching in a different way.
And it's like, why are you still watching this? This is terrible. People are dying.
Might be.
Well, okay, so that's...
But it goes to, like, what I think the movie's, like, ultimately all about, which is the stories that we tell to one another about who we are, and the stories that we tell to other people about other people, and how that affects how we treat them. Like, that narrator makes you aware that you're being told a story by somebody else about these people.
Well, and that's the thing, because Tarantino so rarely doesn't have something that he's also trying to say. Not just make a good movie, but like he seems like he's always trying to flip the script or get you to talk about something or show you something in such a contrasted way to the way that we are used to dealing with it that you can't not think about it. And that's kind of the problem, because Tarantino's films are often controversial, and we've had similar conversations, at least on this podcast, about, you know, when movies or there's TV shows like Game of Thrones or something, and people are like, oh, should we really be watching that? And I kind of got to ask you guys, like where is that line? Because when is language violent, especially violence in a Tarantino film, questionable morality? I mean, Elijah, you've already pointed out, you know, you can enjoy the Tarantino films even if you don't agree with kind of like what they're saying or what they appear to be thematically moving towards. Or even, you know, some of these films like have kind of excessive sexual content. Like, is there a line where it's too, like, it's not worth it? Because I mean, The Hateful Eight, like we said, spoilers, it's chock full of excessive violence, plenty of vulgarity, a lot of which people pointed out was, again, much like Django Unchained, like using like the heavy use of the N-word, which, you know, in society is like the biggest no-no, but you have like this white dude who is just, you know, lacing his scripts with it and telling us there's a really good reason. So, you know, like, is there a line? What's the line? Like, when's a movie too crass to engage with? Like, is there a balance between theme and crassness?
JR, you want to go first?
Sure. You know, I would say my short answer is I think that is entirely up to individual people to make that discernment. You ought, especially if you live in the real world, either real world, you should, if you're wise, you should cultivate a pretty sharp understanding of what you can handle and what you can't. And I think this issue is very much for believers, it falls in the realm of the weak and the strong that Paul talks about in Romans and 1 Corinthians, where people are going to have different levels of what they're able to engage with, and you ought to know your own limits, and you ought not force those on other people, and you also ought not encourage other people who have said, you know, that's just not for me. You shouldn't encourage them to partake anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that, I mean, that's my short answer to it. I think the longer answer, again, for me, one of the reasons I wanted to see this movie is because I knew it would be part of the cultural conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so in general, to, because I love what you're saying, and I think it's where we treaded that line. But there was a time when I was like, of course we're gonna do a Tarantino film. Of course we're gonna cover it on the podcast, because just like you're saying, it's gonna be part of the cultural conversation. People are gonna go see this movie. But then when I saw it, I said, do the topics that specifically Tarantino, the points he tries to raise, could they be, are they worth engaging? Are they that good?
I think in this film in particular, which, I mean, I reached out to you mm-hmm. and asked if you were going to cover Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
Because I think the topics Tarantino addresses and the way he addresses them, and he intentionally and specifically brings Christianity into that conversation in the film visually. And so, I mean, he's making some, in my mind, pretty clear commentary about faith, about American identity, about, as Elijah said, like our identity as individuals. And I certainly want to engage that conversation. Yeah. I, as a person who is not only as a professing Christian, but as someone who's vocationally a pastor, I want to participate in that conversation. I don't want to just abdicate it to people who don't have the same standards I do.
Yeah,
because I think the conversation is important, and I disagree pretty sharply with some of what Tarantino says.
Mm.
I want to answer your explicit content question, Mikey. I've been thinking about listening to JR there for a moment too. I thought a lot about this this explicit content thing when I was younger. I didn't allow myself to watch anything sexually explicit at all in movies. I was 25 years old before I would let myself watch explicit sex scenes or nudity in films. I would literally walk out of the room if I walked in, watched a movie with people, and have them call me back in when the scene was over. Mm-hmm. when I was younger.
Yeah.
And it was and language and violence weren't the same. That I didn't do the same thing with language and violence. Typical evangelical
yeah.
Christian. I was really strict about it. And it took a lot of people who had some patience with me, and it took a lot of learning to learn how to kind of understand how to understand what filmmakers were saying through their use of explicit content in films. Sexuality, yeah. Violence, language, whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think, like, as I think about it now, like, I wonder if the reason that we're, like, the question I like to ask is, like, why are we worried about what we're watching? You know, like, what is the underlying concern, you know? And I think it is, like, what you're saying, JR, you know, like, we need to be aware of what we can handle, you know, and what people that we're responsible for can handle. You definitely don't want to make someone watch something that's going to traumatize them, you know? And so I think it comes down to that same thing personally as well. Like, what can we handle? Like, emotionally, you know, like, that's kind of what we're talking about. And, I think that's correct. Like, I think we should be careful. I think we also should be growing in what we're able to handle emotionally. Like, I think that's part of becoming more mature in all things, not just with movies, you know, is having a better handle on our emotions. And I actually think that movies can provide a really good, they're an opportunity to grow emotionally. If you kind of walk yourself slowly into more complicated emotions. And I think they do provide that opportunity. And so, like, maybe my younger brother can't handle a Tarantino movie right now, but one day I would like him to be able to do that, you know?
Yeah, you'd never force him into it.
No, but, you know, but like over time, like maybe work his way up to that kind of thing, you know, with other films and whatnot. So like, I think there are people, and it's fine, who are like strictly opposed to anything like watching anything like what you've seen the Tarantino movie. And I would never, like you said, force them to do that. I do think we should be growing in our emotional capacity and our emotional maturity, though, at the same time.
Yeah, you know, the scriptures, I think what's confusing for some people, and is maybe a part of the end game of this podcast, Mikey, is a lot of people hear, I can watch a Tarantino movie and they think, oh, well, JR's just saying he can take all that in. And I don't think he can. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's okay. And the scriptures talk about sifting, right? And being wise. And so I think the problem is when someone isn't trained, because it is a skill you learn, isn't mm-hmm. trained in how to assess a film critically, or a person who doesn't watch film to grow emotionally. You know, they watch mm-hmm. film to escape, or they watch film to shut their brain off, not turn their brain on, and not mm-hmm. wake their soul up. Then yeah, like maybe it's not the best thing that they just, you know, mindlessly consume all of these things, because mm-hmm. then without that sifting, it will shape them in ways that are bad, you know? And so maybe I would say, if you're going to watch something that is, you're afraid is going to be explicit in whatever way, violence, language, nudity of any kind, sexuality, you probably ought to have a critical lens engaged. I, though, would push it a step further, which is, again, where I think your podcast goes, say entertainment is never mindless. It's never. Like, even a quote-unquote innocuous film like a Pixar movie mm-hmm. is shaping you, mm-hmm. and it's sending you a message, and you ought, as a responsible human being, be aware that that's happening and engage that critically and decide whether you agree with it or not, whether it's something that's healthy to be shaping you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say I can't really argue with any of that. Obviously, I picked the perfect guest to be on this to wax poetic so well. I actually really like what both of you guys are saying, because it's not about... I mean, it's if you've decided that something is not for you, that's not necessarily wrong, but the encouragement would be to grow wiser, to grow with more wisdom, and to learn how to engage entertainment, I guess, always with your brain on, whether it seems harmful or perfectly pleasant.
Yeah. And you'll actually, I believe you actually get more enjoyment out of it if you're watching it. Critically is like too strong of a word, mm-hmm. or too hard of a word, you know?
Thoughtfully?
Like, thoughtfully. Yeah. If you're just paying attention, to put it real simply, you're going to enjoy what you're watching more, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you really are. It's more fun to watch something thoughtfully than it is to turn your brain off, I think. Yeah. I mean, and
it's like long-term gratification.
It is, yeah. And we're not encouraged to do that. Like, we're totally not encouraged to do that. Mm-hmm. We're encouraged to be consumers that sit there and just, like, shovel in stuff and don't think about it at all. Like, that's what everybody out there wants us to do. And that's not how we should be watching movies. Like, I try not to be too moralistic about a lot of things, but we should be thoughtful about culture, you know? Really should. Everybody should.
Well, Elijah, follow-up... The follow-up question, I guess, for you is what JR already answered. And do you typically find that – I mean, we probably already know the answer, but just so you can articulate, do you find that Tarantino tries to tackle things that are worth wading into the muck of his films usually bring?
Yeah, totally. absolutely. You know, the curious thing is I disagree with him about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But I do think he is seriously trying to talk about some stuff with his movies, you know? And that actually comes back to another reason why the explicit content of his films, I don't think is a reason not to watch them. It's kind of like with people, like you can meet a person who like curses a blue streak and says all kinds of terrible things and does bad stuff, but you probably shouldn't write that person off, you know? Like God still loves that person, and you should still take that person seriously and love that person. And I feel like with some filmmakers, there's not all movies, but some filmmakers, some films, like even if they are course, they're still worth your attention, you know, because they still care about some stuff. If I don't, I don't have to like his language to care about the things he cares about.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, not that we could not continue discussing this aspect of it for a while, but we've been at this topic or at this discussion for quite some time, and we've really not done any justice about talking about the content of the movie itself. And so I want to transition just a little bit, but still start from the very beginning, because there has been a lot of note made that has been made about like the first thing we really see in the film, which is like the slow pan.
Jesus.
Yeah. Over this crucifix covered in snow. So, JR, what do you think Tarantino is doing? Because we're already admitting that Tarantino probably has a reason, because he's an excellent filmmaker, he's a great storyteller, and he's very thoughtful when he does these things. So he probably has something that he's trying to kind of get us to think about or ponder or make a point. So why do you think we're lingering on this image at the very beginning of the film for so long?
So I'll tell you my working out of it, which I'm nearly certain is not enough, but I'll tell you how I got there.
Okay.
So yeah, long lingering shot on the snow covered crucifix. And all I did in my mind when I was watching the movie was, okay, this movie's about religion. I don't know what this means, but I'm just going to like file that, you know, put, you know, stick that on the corkboard to pull back down at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And see what he says. And then the other major moment for me that was explicitly Christian was during that scene between Major Warren and General Smithers, that Bob, who probably is my favorite character in the film, Demian Bashir, who I love, and I'm so glad he's getting some attention. He's incredible. But he's playing Silent Night on the piano, you know. And there are a couple of offhanded references, but that's like the clearest thing you get that this is a Christmas movie, you know, that it's not just winter, it's Christmas time. And so here's what I got from it. So overall, it felt to me like this film was, and I'm happy to expand more on this in a little bit, but I want to talk specifically about religion. This film was specifically about the idea that you never know, really, you can't know if someone else's stories are true.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, at the end of the day, all we have is we're taking someone's word for it.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I think the film was saying it doesn't actually matter whether they're true. What matters is whether you believe they're true or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because over and over and over in the film, people were telling stories, and the events of the film unfold based on who does or does not believe those various stories.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of notable exceptions. One of them being that the coffee is really poisoned, and it doesn't matter whether you know it's poisoned or not, like it's poisoned.
Yeah.
But, you know, overall. And so, I thought that the playing of Silent Night was incredibly, fascinating, because Christmas is a story that's almost entirely false the way we tell it. Jesus was not born in December. The little Lord Jesus did cry because he was a baby. We don't know what animals were in the stable. The wise men weren't in the manger scene. I mean, we go on and on and on about all of these pieces of our beloved Christmas story that we know are straight up not true, but it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter for a couple of reasons. One, it doesn't matter because we like our nativity scenes, and we have our traditions, and we had to get those pagans to quit worshiping the winter solstice somehow. And the other reason it doesn't matter is because what the story is really about at the end of the day is God becoming human. And if the details get a little jumbled, well, the core, the meat of the story is true. If I can be really crude and on point with my metaphor. So that's what I thought. That was sort of what I did with that cross, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know that Tarantino would agree with me that the meat of the story is true or not. But for me, that was where I sort of landed with his commentary on religion. Was I don't know that it matters how much of this Jesus stuff is true. What matters is that a whole bunch of people believe it's true.
Yeah. Mm. No, that's good.
That's good. No, that's really good. I hadn't you know, you see the Jesus thing, and I've seen a lot of people writing about the Jesus as like a counterpoint of mercy or something like that, which doesn't ring true to me at all.
Yeah.
But that's really good, though, because that fits totally in with the story thing. and what stories we believe is true. Because when they get to that end, the very end of the film, when they're rereading the letter, when they're rereading the letter, and they decide, like, he's like, that's a good letter. That's a good story.
He says that's a good story.
It's a good story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he crumbles it up and throws it away because it doesn't matter because they died.
Because they die anyway. You're all going to die anyway. But right, that's a good story, you know? Like, that's really good. That totally fits.
And what was that story? It was all about Lincoln's dream of what America could be.
Could be.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I love that. I mean, if this movie made it in my top 15 for the year, top 10, it was in my top 10, and that's why. Like, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And that works really well with all the race stuff, too, you know? There's been a lot made of Tarantino's appearance at a Black Lives Matter rally and stuff like that, you know, but it totally makes sense. It's almost like he wants to say, this may be the story that our country has told, and that might be a true story of, like, terrible racism, all this kind of stuff, but we need to believe a new story about reconciliation and white and black and everybody else coming together, you know? That makes perfect sense. And if we have to believe some lies, some fabrications to get there, totally worth it, you know?
Well, it reminds me of a friend of the show, Wade Bearden, actually on his Letterboxd review. He talked about that final shot and how they were reading that letter and how it seemed like Tarantino was making fun of war movies, because often the final shot in lots of war movies is like the slow pan up the flagpole, to where there's only the stars and stripes, you know, like America, greatest kind of thing ever, because we fought for something and it was beautiful and right and just and all that. And it seems, he said it seems to be that Tarantino's interpretation of American history, this is what patriotism means to him. It's all fake, basically. Villains, racist, and violent men take property that don't belong to them, killing and pillaging along the way, and there are no good guys. It's just a bloody mess, and even religion has been distorted to fit a corrupt manifest destiny when people want to use the story to their advantage. And so he even talks about Silent Night being used and how, you know, it's just another piece of the puzzle, and people want to believe that, like, the people that formed this great country of awesomeness were all these great patriots and good people, but it's a whole, I mean, like, America was founded by a bunch of people, you know, outlaws, you know, money hungry, you know, working the backs of immigrants and building their fortunes. Like, these are the people that built America. And we don't really talk about it that way because we've chosen to believe a different story about our history, one that kind of typically washes over racism a lot of times.
Or at least
downplays it.
And I think that's what I loved about the way Tarantino wove this film together. And really, it's one of the reasons I begged Mikey to be on this episode, because I wanted to talk about it with someone, is that there are different ways of remembering the past, and they don't, let's just throw this out there, and you guys can crucify me for it if you want. None of them are true. Like, none of the ways to remember the past are true. It's always through a filter of memory, and memory is always unreliable. And so if we're remembering, we can choose how we remember, and we can tell our story in a way that silences and oppresses and perpetuates injustice, or we can tell it in a way that helps us imagine a better world. You know, and I think it's interesting that Abraham Lincoln letter, in a way, did the latter. It was a lie that actually made the world more just, even if it was just for Major Warren.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know.
Well, I'm gonna say it's not that hard to believe that we all look or tell stories from the past with rose-colored glasses when you think about the fact that most people, I would say everyone, but, you know, I tend to steer from absolutes most of the time, but even in the present, most people look at their own world currently with rose color, or they bring their own worldview or whatever word you want to use. You know, they're interpreting their present through their experiences. You know, this is why you have people saying or arguing that if people, you know, if you just work hard enough, you can achieve what I've achieved. But people are like, no, you don't understand what it's like to be me. Like, you can't work hard enough to overcome poverty in some areas or social inequality. And so people are still currently interpreting the world through their own experiences or their own lenses. So it's not that hard to believe that people would interpret the past the same way.
So I'm sitting here thinking about everything.
all the things.
And with so much of this, so much of the commentary on The Hateful Eight, I find myself like really appreciating something that someone has seen in the film, but I take it a completely different way than they take it. So like with what Wade wrote, you know, mm-hmm. about Tarantino's interpretation of American history, that this is what patriotism is. It's all faux, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Wade in his little letterbox comment doesn't go any further to like say whether he thinks that's a good thing or not.
Yeah.
There's another one. Y'all know Andrew Johnson. He's
the president.
The president, yeah.
Not actually the president.
what did he think of this movie?
I would actually love to know that.
Right up his alley.
That would be great fun.
He would be like, I can't believe that's going to happen. Civil War, you say, what?
But Andrew wrote about that final image as well. And he sees it as a perverse American flag. Let me read his thing here. Few images have stayed with me as much as that of Goggins and Jackson laughing as they gaze at Lee's dead body, the white of their shirts contrasting with the saturated red of their blood and the blue of the blanket they're lying on to create a perverse American flag. And then Andrew goes on to say balance is an inherent part of our national identity. Tarantino seems to be saying, he says. And thus the only way for reconciliation to occur is for balance to be inflicted on another party. So like, I love what Andrew saw there, like the idea of that flag being what Tarantino's going for. I love what Wade says about it's the all faux stuff.
Yeah.
But that both those things, they both kind of take it to a pessimistic direction.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think that's actually what Tarantino is saying.
Do tell.
I think he's probably saying, yeah, it's bloody, it's fake, it's all this stuff, but it's still beautiful, and there is still hope for reconciliation. You know, like, because it is beautiful. Like, that last image, it's terrible because you got a woman hanging there in the left side of the frame, you know, but you got these two guys who hated each other, like, probably more than anybody else hated each other in the whole movie, and they're actually on the same side by the end of it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Which is beautiful. Amazing.
Which is beautiful.
Yeah.
It is actually beautiful. And even if it's fake, it's beautiful. And that goes along with what you were saying, JR, about the religion stuff, you know? It's like, even if it's not true, even if we create this narrative around this thing that's not actually what it is, if we believe it and it helps us do good things, Tarantino might be saying, then it's worth it. You know? Like, it's good. Even if the Lincoln letter is fake, it's good. Kind of thing.
Well, so how does that line up with what we would say we actually believe?
I think truth is truth.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask. Like historicity. Yeah. Let's talk about if we can take a big tangent. Like, let's talk about the biblical texts, right? Like, where do you draw the line for what things need to be more or less as they are represented in the biblical text, and which things are allowed to be myth, metaphor, exaggeration, fiction? Like, does Jonah have to be historical, or can it be a parable?
Jonah can be a parable for me.
Me too, right?
But I mean, true.
People have been fired over that.
Yeah, well, totally, you know? I'm going to have to shut this podcast down, guys.
I just don't know if I can...
We just lost Mikey's salvation.
Oh my gosh! Well, I think you both just lost your salvation, and that's the problem.
Well, hey, I work for a seminary that a lot of people don't like because they don't espouse strict biblical literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And how does Fuller say it? The Bible is in everything that the Bible affirms. The Bible is literal or something like that, how they say it. I don't know. I in my Old Testament
I just work there.
I just work there. It's hard sometimes. I asked my Old Testament professor one time. I took an Old Testament writings class, John Golden Gay. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant man. I said, you know, what needs to be true for you in the Old Testament, like factually true?
Historical, and, right?
Do what?
Historical.
Historical, yeah, like actually had to happen in the Old Testament. And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, the crossing of the Red Sea. He said, it didn't necessarily have to be that there was a giant ocean that split apart and they walked through it like we see in, you know, the movies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. He said, but something had to happen. He said, that event is so important for Israel, for the Jewish people. Like, it shows up again and again and again and again in their liturgies and how they define themselves and everything. Something had to happen,
yeah.
He says.
I mean, because it was obviously something that they keep pointing back to.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so, like, so the same thing kind of works for me, like, when you look at the New Testament, you know? And, like, I believe that Jesus lived and died and rose from the dead. Like, actually bodily resurrection.
Yeah,
like, I believe that.
Yeah.
Physical resurrection, you know? And the reason I believe that is because when you look at the way that those disciples wrote and talked and lived after that, something had to happen, you know? Like, something had to happen.
Something, yeah.
Something, yeah. And,
yeah.
You know, the Gospels, they contradict one another in the order of events and what people say and when and who and all
how
that
many,
kind of
stuff. How many people were there, yeah.
Exactly. They contradict each other all the time. And it's like giving you different aspects on one story, different points of view on one story. And I don't think any of them tell the complete 100% factual account of what happened. Mm-hmm. But something happened. Something happened.
So I would say with that same question, I would answer it in two ways. If you were to say what has to have happened for you, mm-hmm. is not necessarily the same answer for me as what do I think did happen.
Yeah.
So the bare minimum for me that has to have happened is basically the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
it's that,
like,
way for me too. Yeah.
That's it. Like, that's if Jesus is not raised from the dead, I'll just follow after Paul, then we above all people are to be pitied. You know,
yeah.
We're fools.
Yeah. But I have friends that that's not true for.
I have, me too. Me too.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not good friends.
And they consider themselves Christians.
Yeah. Not good friends.
Yeah.
I have friends that don't.
I have good friends.
Yeah. Good friends who I respect and love. Who
are smarter than I am.
Who are smarter than I am. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And better looking.
Well, yeah, that's a low bar, but yeah.
Well, so yeah, I think that's a great distinction, because I think getting into this discussion is the type of discussion that makes people feel really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah, sure.
And it's something that, like, I thought a lot about on and off, and, you know, I'm not sure where I land on a lot of this stuff, but I do know that it's important when you have that discussion with people that you do make that distinction, because it is really important what has to have happened, or basically like Christendom would crumble, and that's why, you know, denomination split and stuff.
See, I think it's only important for right here in this conversation that we're having right now. Like, I think it's important for the conversation you have with somebody else. Like, ultimately, I don't think it's important what I believe about what had to happen, because ultimately it's not up to me, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's important how it affects our relationship or my relationship with other people, but it's not cosmically important what I believe about anything.
I mean, it is mine.
Thank goodness. So,
yeah.
Thank goodness it's not, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. And there are, you know, there are people that I am not enough. There are many people that I am not enough of a biblical literalist for. So they would consider me not a Christian.
Yeah.
And
but you know what? It's not to them either. Thank goodness.
I know, right? Yeah. And so I just kind of shrug my shoulders and just keep doing the best I can. And one of the reasons I'm a Nazarene pastor is because our statement on scripture is broad enough to incorporate me and the hyper-literalists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've told people from the pulpit many times, for instance, you're allowed to believe in evolution and be a Nazarene. You're also allowed to be a six-day creationist and be a Nazarene. What you're not allowed to do is tell someone else they're not allowed to be a Nazarene because they don't agree with you. So...
Yeah. So and this is why we should watch Quentin Tarantino movies, right?
Exactly.
Like, well, to have this conversation.
Right.
But that's the thing. So is Tarantino simply saying that we need to think about this, or is he saying, like, or does it seem like he's saying that it matters? Because we're kind of saying that it doesn't necessarily. So, well, there are things that matter to us personally, but
I would like to think he's saying. Off, oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to piggyback off you.
Yeah.
So okay. I think what he's saying is that the story, what matters is not whether or not something happened. It's whether you believe it happens and how that belief causes you to behave.
Right. How it makes you treat other people.
Yep.
Yep.
So I don't agree with that. I mean, yeah. So I think Tarantino would say about Christianity, right? It doesn't matter whether or not there even was a guy named Jesus, let alone whether or not he was God incarnate and he was raised from the dead. What matters is if your faith causes you to be the kind of a person who supports, even by your passivity, systemic inequalities and injustices, or whether your that belief that you have in this person who you claim was raised from the dead causes you to fight for justice and to speak up for those who can't be spoken up for. If that's what your belief causes you to do, then it's a good story. And if it causes you to be a terrible person, then it's a terrible story.
It's a terrible story, yeah. Which again, is what you're saying is not what we would believe.
I think I will go quite a ways down that road.
Mm-hmm.
But I also believe that unless Jesus was raised from the dead and fundamentally rewrote the fabric of the universe, then it doesn't matter anyway. And actually, right. We should crumble up all the letters and just laugh.
Yes. Yeah, I'm on the same page with you there. But see, this thing about Tarantino, you get into these like multi-layered conversations about agreeing with him and disagreeing with him at the exact same time.
Yeah.
But there was cussing in it.
Right.
Hey, can we call it vulgarity? Because it like vulgarity makes it sound worse. And there are some really bad words.
There is some really impressive vulgarity.
There were also plenty of vulgar statements that didn't have any cussing in them.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay, well, ordinarily, getting to this point, I would want to start wrapping up, but there is one more thing that I want us to hit on. And it may take us a while, and if so, then this podcast is just going to go long, but it might not.
Can I pause you real quick?
I'm paused.
To throw something in here that I wanted to mention earlier that I didn't get to. On Christian imagery or whatever, something else that I think is fascinating. Josh Larson wrote in his review of The Revenant about a moment in The Revenant where DiCaprio, and I think they call him the Buffalo Warrior is the name of the Native American he's sitting with. They sit in the snow and they catch snowflakes on their tongue.
Yeah.
And Josh pointed out that it looks exactly like taking a communion wafer in a Catholic church where it's like laid on your tongue as a moment.
Oh,
of
yeah. Oof. That's nice.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Like it's great. That Josh is brilliant.
Totally a Larson moment.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He's so great. But there's a similar moment in The Hateful Eight where Daisy is sitting in the snow after getting beat.
Mm-hmm.
And she just like opens her mouth and lets a snowflake fall on her tongue. And given the other Christian religious imagery in the movie, I would bet on the fact that that's what Tarantino was pointing to, was that moment of mercy, that little bit of a communion snowflake, if you will. Anyway, go ahead. You can keep going. I just wanted to put that in there because I think it's fascinating.
No. Like, that's the thing that I wanted to try to get to with the original question. So it's good that you thought that too, because there was, or so rarely do we get to see such blatant religious imagery. Lots of time it's like, look, we have a Christ, like a loose Christ figure, you know, who's kind of quasi Christly in there, you know, never perfect metaphor, and it feels like restraining, but rarely do we get like a 10-minute opening pan of a crucifix, you know, to start a movie. So obviously there was some intention to it, and I wanted to point out most of it as possible. But the other thing is this conversation that I think was one of the first things that really struck me is like Tarantino trying to say something. And it's this speech that Mowbray gives about justice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's the hangman, and he's like the hangman is impartial. That's what makes him just.
Mm-hmm.
Because he only
of course, his He's lying at the moment of who he is.
And he's totally lying.
Yeah.
So I think that is something to take in take into account. But I was curious if it struck a chord with either of you, because he tries to, you know, he talks about frontier justice and how frontier justice kind of is like gratifying, but not justice, and goes back to talk about actual justice, which is rarely gratifying.
Mm. Well, you know, this is one of those things where, like, the question that Tarantino has put before us,
mm-hmm.
I think, is the wrong question. You know, it's like what kind of justice do you want?
Mm-hmm.
And the actual question we should be asking is, who does justice belong to? And it's not to us.
Boom.
You know, it's it's not ours.
Did you drop that mic and then just pick it right back up?
I imagine Elijah just kind of knocked over his mic a little bit. It was probably like sitting on a table, and then he kind of carefully picked it back up.
If I knocked it over, I would hit my coffee pot. I do have a pot of coffee sitting beside me, and I'm drinking it out of one of our camping mugs, just for the authenticity sake of the podcast.
Have you been slowly pouring it into your mug during?
I thought
I heard it a little bit
the entire time. Yeah,
You were drinking.
Fortunately, I have not vomited blood at this point, so apparently I'm safe in my own home
for now. JR or I use a much slower working poison.
Mm.
Whoever it might be, I'm not sure. Well, okay, so I still think it's a great conversation to have, though, because even though he's asking the wrong question, I think once you try to answer the question that he's posing about justice, you eventually will get to the answer that, you know, you jump to, Elijah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's right. I mean, in the question he poses, in the parameters of his question, he's correct. Frontier justice is satisfying.
Yeah.
At least temporarily. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it works so much with this movie, because we don't know enough about Daisy to understand how bad she is. Bad in quotation marks. They're all bad.
Yeah.
But if you go back to something like Inglourious Basterds, it is satisfying to watch Adolf Hitler getting his face shot in, you know?
Yeah.
One of my favorite Tarantino stories is they premiered Inglourious Basterds at a Holocaust museum for Holocaust survivors.
Oh my gosh.
Right? I know. Like, this is why I love Tarantino, because the dude just goes for it. And before the movie, he introduced the movie, right? He walked out and he said, "All right, who's ready to kill Hitler?" Like, that was how he introduced the movie to these Holocaust survivors. And like, that's like, it is satisfying if you accept his parameters of that question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, frontier justice is just, it's satisfying. It absolutely is. But it's probably satisfying as hell, you know, in the long run.
That was such a great phrase. You're just killing it, Elijah.
There you go.
You're killing it.
The thing I thought that was fascinating about that whole conversation, again, what I took from it, and one of the reasons I love Westerns, is that the veneer of civilization is thinner on the frontier.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so what I sort of took away from it was, again, this idea that justice is a story that we all tell each other to make ourselves feel better about living with these other people who we never really know. Because you never know anyone but yourself. You never know if someone else is lying to themselves or to you. And so at the end of the day, the actions look the exact same and the results are the exact same. And the only difference is that we've sort of arbitrarily agreed that one is okay and one is not. And that's as much of a fiction as any other lie in the film.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Which I just thought was hilarious and fantastic and fascinating.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, like, I agree with him and disagree with him at the exact same time.
Yes. Yeah. Yep, me too.
Yeah, yep. And it reminds me a lot of how I feel, like, typically when I watch a Joss Whedon film, because I feel like he will point out this truth that people have always thought about or avoided thinking about at great cost. And then he comes to a conclusion, which I'm like, yes, but you need to take it further. In this case, that's what it is. Because he obviously makes, you know, you give a speech like this. The character Mulberry gets up there and gives a speech. But as Elijah pointed out, he was lying about who he was. Mm-hmm. You know, so like there's more of a metaphor there than meets the eye. So I love that it's layered. I love that it's making us have this conversation. And I wish more movies would make us have these type of conversations.
Yeah, but it had cussing in it.
It did have cussing in it.
Well, you know, I don't expect Tarantino to give me more of an answer than that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think we should, you know, like considering what he has accomplished with this film and other films, like, why should we ask him for more? Like, he didn't have to solve the world's problems.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, like, it's fine for him to present a qualified truth, I think. Like, it is up to us to take it a step further. That's what we should do.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think that's one of the, I think that's one of the best things a storyteller can do. I mean, there are parables, and there are, you know, like Jesus came down and told stories, and lots of times he made people have to try to answer really hard questions without telling them the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, of course, obviously Jesus had the right answer. And we're not saying that Tarantino has the right answer and he's just not telling it to us, but I think that's what some of the best stories do. That's why I love science fiction so much, because science fiction puts us in a world where we can like hyper stylize the things that maybe we don't notice on a daily basis. That's why typically you get like sexism and social inequality, all kinds of like starvation, exploitation, imperialism. You get all that really easy in sci-fi, and you get to deal with it right on the surface because you're never really having to talk about it, but you're making people think about it. Mm-hmm. So, well, with that said, I know we're going to probably be going along now, and so we will kind of start winding it down. And as usual, we do that by first talking about our come on moments, which will be the moments that, you know, just didn't work for us. It could be a character. It could be a shot. It could be a moment. Basically anything, a feeling that you got from the movie. Something that just didn't work for you. Either you wished it was done differently, left out, etc. So, Elijah, what was it about this movie? Or what was something about this movie that just rubbed you the wrong way?
I've got two. Okay. The first one is, all right, so Tarantino does this one thing really well in his movies, or he has before, where he suggests things to you that you then picture in your head and you don't actually see them on the screen. But after the movie, you think you've seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So like a good example would be in Reservoir Dogs, it's Mr. Somebody says, did you see what happened to that black girl? You know, like, and he just like puts that little seed into your head where you imagine later that you saw what happened to that black girl. But you never did. He never shows you that, you know? He does that really well in some of his movies. but in this one, he didn't just do that. He went ahead and showed you. So you take the story about that that Samuel L. Jackson tells about meeting Bruce Dern's son, mm-hmm. you know? Like, I think in an earlier Tarantino movie, when maybe he had less money, couldn't go ahead and shoot it, all that kind of stuff, he would have just had him tell the story, and you would have had to picture it. And I think by showing it to you, it takes some of the power away of what that story could have had. Like, if you were just having to hear it, you would have been in Bruce Dern's position of imagining it mm-hmm. and picturing it. But by showing you, you're in this other narrative level position. It also kind of makes it more true, and I don't think that story is necessarily true. I think it's possible that Marquise Warren. I think it's possible he's lying just to antagonize the general.
So can I weigh in on that real quick?
Yeah.
Clay and I, my Storyman co-host and housemate Clay Wynn, saw this. We saw the Roadshow, and so we were walking out talking about it, and he pointed out that the sheriff, probably, character, Sheriff Chris Mannix, who was fantastic, Walter Goggins, he is right every time he calls BS on a story.
Mm.
He's right about the letter, and there are a few other times that he's right, and he does say that Warren is making up the story to get Smithers to shoot him.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we don't have any proof.
Right.
And I think intentionally we don't have any proof. But Mannix is... And the other thing I think is interesting about Mannix is that in that carriage that was being pulled at the very beginning, there mm-hmm. were 8 horses and 7 were black and 1 was white.
One was white.
And I don't yeah. know. I don't know if that's meant to indicate that there's a character who's the most honest, which would be Mannix. I mean, he's the one that apparently never lied about anything, even his own sheriff, Enos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if that is the case, it would be interesting that Warren's story to the general mm-hmm. is fiction.
Yeah.
Fabricated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is sort of how yeah. I read it anyway. But I agree with you that the scene, it lent it an air of credibility.
Yeah. And I just think that Tarantino couldn't resist, you know, like I just think he wanted you to see it. And I yeah. think that's a shame. Like, it would have been more powerful without it. Mm-hmm. That's one of my come on moments. Yeah. That's good, though, about Mannix. I didn't think about the fact that he never lies, but that's actually true. He's wrong sometimes, but he never lies.
Mm-hmm. He was right about Joe Gage.
That's true.
I love Walter Goggins.
He's good. It took me, the first time I saw it, I didn't much like him. And he grew on me as the movie went along. Second time, I loved him from the get-go. My other come on moment, though, ties into the last couple of Tarantino films, actually. And I get it that he wants you to know you're watching a movie. I get that. And to be aware of the artifice, you know. But when people's heads are exploding in this movie, it just takes me out of the movie in a way I'm not sure he intends. It's so gratuitous, you know. It's so gratuitous. And it's not as big a problem in this one as I think it was in Django Unchained.
In Django.
Yeah, but it's still, like, I just wish he wasn't doing that. And I wrote about this in my review of the film that I feel like in his real world movies, he doesn't do that as much than in his movies. Mm. And I think this is a movie, and so that's why he feels it's okay to do that kind of thing. But it just, I wish he didn't do it so much. Like, It actually, the second time I saw the movie, I felt really sad for Daisy when she's sitting there with her brother's brains on her face, you know? Like,
yeah.
That it took me out of the movie in a way I don't think Tarantino intended. Yeah.
Hmm. Do you think there is any way that Tarantino is making a concession or like a pre-counter argument to the arguments against his film? When people are like, oh, because he knows people are going to come and say, you know, this was violent and incredibly vulgar. How could you make a movie that uses this in such a serious way? And he's like, people's heads exploded. Why are you taking this that seriously?
He probably is. Yeah, that's probably what he's doing. You know, he definitely likes to make little referential things to his critics, to his negative critics. So that's probably what he's doing. It just as his filmography has gone along, he just does it more and more, just right in your face, you know. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work as well. Like people always say, the best scene in Kill Bill is the anime sequence, which is the bloodiest sequence in the movie. But it's also an anime, so it's like super stylized, you know. Mm-hmm. And it works better than seeing all people's heads explode. For me, anyway. Yeah.
Well, JR. What do you have?
Yeah, I mean, all the complaints I have are minor. I get the gore thing, though. Daisy's in particular horrified me, I think, in a way that made me empathetic towards her in a way I hadn't been in the film yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love Channing Tatum, but he wasn't like the greatest. I wanted him to be. I was so happy for him to be in a Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
And when I saw his name in the credits, I was like, what? So I kind of forgot that he was in it until, you know, they cut to that scene and I was like, oh gosh. But he didn't quite, like, almost, but not quite. Here's what I felt. I felt like I could tell he was trying, you know, like I could see through like he did a good job, but I felt like I could feel it. He didn't feel like he was completely inhabiting the character the way everyone else in the movie did.
Yeah.
So,
do you think that's because it was Channing Tatum, Or do you think that's because, honestly, we got to spend a lot more time with almost every character?
No, from the get-go, from the first time he walks into Minnie's haberdashery, I just didn't believe him. In a different way from the way I learned to disbelieve all of the other characters in the film. And then I would say the last small thing, if I could have changed anything, I just wanted more Bob. If I could have an entire Bob prequel, I would take it. when he says, "You got me. I am laissez-faire about hats." Like, I about lost it. Like, it was such a great moment. Everything he did. Like, and then again, watching it the second time through and knowing that he's lying the whole time and just how quick he is and how smart he is. Just fantastic.
Oh, man. All right. So
I kind of like Channing Tatum, for the record.
Okay.
I thought it was fun. Like, I kind of wish there was more of him. I wish he'd had more of a movie to, like, settle into his role and develop that more, you know? Like, because I really enjoy him. I mean, I don't want to go all the way back to Jupiter Ascending. I enjoy him in a movie. I kind of feel like...
We could talk about 21 and 22 Jump Street instead, then.
We could, actually.
We already have.
I like those movies. But I think it's one of those things. He's kind of... I agree with you that it kind of doesn't work because of when he shows up in the movie, I think. Because it kind of is like, oh, there's a movie star, you know? And what Tarantino does so well is kind of quirky characters that actors that you don't always see and stuff. He's a little bit too big. It's kind of like the Brad Pitt problem in Inglourious Basterds, you know? You just get more of him, more of Brad Pitt to settle into and appreciate how broad he's being, so...
Well, yeah. It's really weird to me because I almost thought for a second that he put Channing Tatum in the movie just to blow his pretty head off.
Maybe.
But I didn't think he was particularly bad or particularly good. He was lukewarm. So.
Yeah.
gosh, come on moment, though. The only thing that I think really bothered me, I think, Elijah, you already basically hit on it. And of all the monologues, I love so many of the monologues, but... I guess I didn't want to see the what Tarantino showed me in the one where Major Warren's talking to the old general.
Yeah.
I wanted his speech to be enough.
Yeah.
Because I thought Samuel L. was delivering those lines so well.
Yeah.
And he was in it. He was completely in it and, like, completely, like you just said, just completely selling that story. That cutting to it actually made me think it was silly.
Yeah.
And it didn't make me, like, sad for the general or what. It just kind of, I don't know, it just was off-putting. I was like, this isn't, like, I don't know. Anyway, it just, of all the very cool monologues, I thought that was the weakest because... It was like he enjoyed it too much.
Mm-hmm.
So I just go on record as saying I actually enjoyed, that's not the right word. I found the visualization effective, because I'm not. So I read in the film, I read the visualization as what the general was seeing.
Imagining.
Because all of the characters spoke with Samuel L. Jackson's cadence. And even when it was his lines, he was mouthing them at the exact, like it was all clearly it was the story being told, not what actually happened, quote unquote, if it actually happened.
So
it helped me believe that this great general who we've seen playing chess and winning at chess repeatedly, would be able to fall for such like an obvious ploy, because he's seeing it and it's removed away from the realm of reason into the realm of his emotion. So I found it very effective, even though you guys didn't.
Well,
no, I like that. It's good.
Objection, is not for the record. It will not be on the record that you thought that was okay. So. Thanks for wasting your breath, JR.
Yep.
There you go. Outvoted 2-1.
I like that though. No, I like that idea that you're seeing what he's imagining. And I think you might be right about that, especially like you said, with the fact that everybody mouths Samuel L. Jackson's words in that. That actually kind of makes sense to me.
I think what I really like is the more and more that the podcast goes on, I feel like, Elijah, you're kind of like Switzerland. Like, you just enjoy talking about it so much. You're like, yeah, it's cool.
I do. That's why this is my Star Wars. Like, I can talk about it forever.
Yeah, oh, that's so awesome.
All the side conversations and all the, like, we can imagine, like, narrative worlds. Or, I mean, whatever. Like, it's just so much fun, you know?
I'm already here.
It's so much fun.
Okay, well then keep it going with it, with your favorite moment. What was the best part of this movie to you?
Oh man.
There's this little bit between when the overture began and the credits ended. It's just gold.
I did love the overture and the intermission quite a bit. My favorite thing about the movie, It's two things, actually, I guess. I love that they shot it in, like, sub-zero degree weather in Telluride. And that when you see people's breath, it's their actual breath. And they were really cold and all that. I love that about the movie. Like, that's, like, you don't, like, okay, have you ever seen Heaven's Gate? The Michael Cimino Western that was, like, historically supposed to be terrible and like a total failure and stuff. Have you ever seen that movie ever?
No.
Again.
All right.
You're
that's
cooler
one.
Than us.
So I don't know about that. I study a lot of stuff. So this is like his. It was like one of the movies that ended the Hollywood auteur era because it cost so much money and it was such a colossal failure. But it was a failure before it was ever released or whatever. But the reason it cost so much is because they like built actual sets in Montana and shot the thing in Glacier National Park. And so all of it like feels super real the whole time. And so does this, you know, because it is like in really cold weather with people wearing actual stuff. My other favorite thing is tied to this. There's an interview that everyone who loves this, maybe you don't like it, if you don't love the movie, if you just kind of like the movie, or if you just enjoy learning about movies, should totally read or listen to, actually. It's with the sound designer for Tarantino's films. And it's let me just look it up real quick and tell you. His name is, here we go.
It's Bob.
If only it was. Mark Olano. Mark Olano is his name, and Film Courage did this thing. I'll send you the link.
Yeah, please do. Mikey. I'll put it in the show notes.
And sorry, didn't mean to do that. So here's the link, and he talks about some of this sound related things in the movie. Like the wind you hear is the actual wind that was blowing through the cabin that they built, Minnie's Haberdashery.
Wow.
Yeah, so like it's like real, and like Tarantino tries really hard to collect as much like in the moment dialogue as possible. So there's the smallest amount of, cause he says it's more real. It feels better, like more vibrant and alive when you catch the real thing. And he tells a story about the guitar that Daisy plays in this interview, because when Kurt Russell, when Hangman Ruth smashes that guitar, that reaction that Jennifer Jason Leigh gives is genuine because he is smashing a 200-year-old guitar that they had gotten just for her to play because of the sound that it has, all that kind of stuff. And he wasn't supposed to smash that guitar. He was supposed to smash a replica that they had built for that moment. But he grabs that guitar and smashes the real guitar and smashes it. And Alano goes on a little bit further in the interview to talk about how they responded to reacting stuff, and it's just like watching a second time, knowing that was true, was so much fun. Like just the degree that Tarantino goes to make a wonderful world to enter into for, in this case, like 3 hours. Like that's my favorite thing about this movie. Yeah,
JR,
Bob,
that's a shocker.
I mean, fantastic.
Is it just because you're Beard Brothers?
No, man. Well, first of all, I've loved Demian Bashir ever since I saw what is it called? It's not A Beautiful Life. I don't remember. I'm gonna have to look up what that movie's even called now, where he plays an illegal immigrant. An amazing film. And we've watched, my wife Amanda and I have watched The Bridge, which he's also fantastic in. So, I mean, I love that he's getting some of these big roles, because I think he's a tremendous actor. And, yeah, that character is just awesome. Like, every scene he's in. The interactions between him and Marquise Warren are amazing. He was such a great part. Like, I think he's by far the most memorable of the Hangman and Joe Gage and, you know, all kind of her who turned out to be her sidekicks.
Mm-hmm.
Loved him.
A Better Life.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh man. Yeah. Have you guys seen that film?
Mm-mm.
No.
It's amazing and terrible.
he was so good. The only one of the cast that didn't work for me, very well. And it's only at the beginning, why is his name escaping me? That's annoying.
What did he do?
Tim Roth. Tim Roth's Mowbray. Because at first I just felt like he was doing a Christoph Waltz impersonation for a while.
Yeah.
And eventually he stops doing that and kind of somebody different or whatever. And I just did. I'm not a big Christoph Waltz fan. So I didn't need to see Christoph Waltz. I do like Christoph Waltz in Inglourious. I think he's amazing in Glorious Bastards, but that's like all I've ever really liked him in a whole lot. I mean, I guess I like him in Django Unchained too. He kind of works well in Tarantino's movies, but really nothing else for me.
Hmm.
Anyway, but I like Tim Roth a lot. I just felt like Tim Roth was like on purpose doing a Christoph Waltz thing, kind of. And I like Tim Roth, so I wish he was like just doing a Tim Roth thing, you know? And eventually he kind of is.
Yeah.
So,
but then he dies.
Well, yeah, but who doesn't?
Well, which leads me to my favorite thing about this movie. And it's something that, it's one of those things that you probably know in the back of your head, but you never actually, until you verbalize it, you don't really know that it's in the back of your head. And even though there's lots of cool moments in the film, I think the reason that I keep coming back to Tarantino films and enjoying them or getting excited that I'm going to see them is because I feel like Tarantino, because he writes and directs and has done it so well, that he doesn't really, like, no one's giving him boundaries.
Mm.
And so when I go into a Tarantino film, like, it's like the only rule is there are no rules. You know, like, there's not necessarily a good guy. The good guys can die. Like, the heroes can die. The bad guys can live. Everyone can die. Probably everyone's not going to live. But in general, like, there's nothing, you know, like you watch most movies and you're like, well, how's the hero going to get out of this? Or, you know, cause you know, what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's just when, you know, when Samuel Jackson gets shot in this movie, like when he is more or less playing the protagonist, to a certain degree at that point, you're like, wait a minute. Oh, that's right. I'm watching a Tarantino film. Everyone's probably going to die. Even the people that we are sort of rooting for. So, I like that. I like the fact that he is able to allow any character to suffer the consequences of the situation without miraculously getting them out of it, and often putting them in a situation that I don't think is too ridiculous for them to have found themselves in to suffer consequences, if that makes sense. So I just like the fact that I never know what's going to happen in a Tarantino film. And that works for me. So I think that's what I enjoy the most. But with that said, well, one last chance for final thoughts. JR, anything you wanted to let people know about the movie?
Gosh, I don't know what else we could possibly tell you. we haven't, I mean, even if you haven't seen the film and you just listen to this, we haven't spoiled it for you, really, because nothing can really spoil a Tarantino film. The joy of it is the dialogue and the visuals. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still well worth seeing if you can handle it.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, What would I say? I would say that The Hateful Eight would make a great double feature with Room. That's what I would say to close this out.
Because they both take place in small, tight, enclosed spaces?
They do, actually. That's one reason. They're also both kind of hard to watch in moments because of what they're showing you. They're also both about the stories that we tell and how those stories define ourselves and our lives and how we interact with other people in the world. One is definitely happier, but the other one is funnier. I'll let you decide which one is which. I think it makes a great double feature with Room. More so than you would, and then the other Western of the year, which is The Revenant. It works better with Room.
You mean Slow West?
I did see Slow West. Yeah, I forgot I saw that.
Or Bone Tomahawk?
Never saw Bone Tomahawk. I haven't seen that one yet. Have we had four Westerns this year? Oh, what a great year. I love Westerns. But it does. It's about a lot of the same things that Room is about.
Mm.
And a lot of Christian imagery in both of them, too.
Yeah.
For the record. Yeah. So.
Well, the only thing I would say is to reiterate the fact that even though we've had a great conversation about kind of, you know, personal understanding of what you can and can't handle, keep in mind, it's a pretty rough film to get through, and it's definitely not for everybody. But if you want to have a really good conversation, or at least the fodder to have a great conversation, this movie is probably a really great starting point, hopefully, as you have heard for the past however long this podcast ends up being. So with that said, you can't have a great podcast that has a great conversation without great guests. So if you want to be able to follow or learn more about or see the work of the guests that have been on, then I want to give them a chance to do that. So, JR, how can people follow what you do or you or whatever?
I'm on Facebook and Twitter at JR Forresteros. And I have several podcasts because I like to talk about a lot of different stuff, and I didn't want to shove them all into one podcast. So you can find all those at NorvalRogers.com/podcast.
That was very efficient.
Thank you.
So efficient that I was actually stunned a little bit. I was going to go get a
I've had a lot of practice.
Yeah. So, Elijah, how can people find what you do or follow your work?
Sure. I write for Real Spirituality, which is the Faith and Film Initiative of the Brim Center at Fuller Seminary. That's a mouthful. I write reviews there pretty much weekly, sometimes a little more often than that.
What are you reviewing this week?
This week I'm not reviewing anything, actually. That's why I said pretty much weekly.
dang it.
Touché. This week I'm not. I'm gearing up for Sundance, though. I'm headed up there next week, and I'll be there all week. I'm going to review as many films as I possibly can. I think festivals are fun because if you're a film critic, you get to like try to – it's like a workout, you know? It's a lot of fun. So that'll all be on Real Spirituality, realspirituality.com/org. Take your pick. But you can follow me on Twitter. That's where I am most of the time, at Elijah Davidson. And I've been writing a book for the past year or so that is going to come out a little bit later this year. It's called How to Talk to a Movie. And it's kind of like a really basic introduction to this whole like film and theology thing. I've kind of geared it towards kind of your high schoolers or a little bit older, but people who haven't had like film education really, or like a film theory education or a theological education. It's kind of an entry point into this larger world. So be on the lookout for that. If you're interested, you can find more about that at my website.
Nice. So. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Fun. And that reminds me too, that you going to Sundance is both, one of my favorite and least favorite things. Because you go and you put out all these reviews, and I really value your opinion on like what kind of was good and what was not good, worth your time and not worth your time. So you will go and write reviews on lots of these movies and be like, oh, you've got to see this movie. And then sometime around, I don't know, November, I'll finally be able to catch one of these movies that you saw at Sundance.
Right, right.
And so I'm like, gosh, Elijah, you're like toying me for 10 months.
Well, okay, speaking of, though, so since we just talked about The Hateful Eight, if we could, just a little quick sidetrack here,
okay.
And Sundance. So last year at Sundance, I saw two movies, well, I saw three movies, I guess, that have really stuck with me. And they're you're going to see all of them in the next few months, finally.
Hold on. The Witch?
The Witch is one of them. That's right, yeah. So The Witch is coming out in March. Get to see The Witch then. If you are into the horror thing, you gotta see The Witch.
Which you should be, because it's the best genre. Go on.
And this one is remarkable. I mean, this is really scary. And it's all in like this like Puritan English, and use a lot of natural light. It's beautifully shot and just really scary. I mean, it's great. Another one is Turbo Kid. And Turbo Kid was in theaters briefly earlier this year.
Yeah, I thought it was briefly. Like August or something.
Yeah, but it's going to be on Netflix.
Excellent.
It's going to be on Netflix on, I think, January 15th, which is like in a couple of days.
Yeah, it's a great film.
You've seen it? You've seen Turbo Kid? Yeah. Oh, man. Like, if you like Tarantino and The Hateful Eight, like, you'll love Turbo Kid. Like, seriously. It's, like, super fun. Super fun. And super violent. Yeah, and then the third one is Last Days in the Desert, which is the Ewan McGregor Jesus movie. So that's coming out in May. It'll be in theaters and whatnot. And that is absolutely worth your time. As far as Jesus movies goes, it's the best one in a long time. Partially because it invents a story around Jesus, so it's not tied to the concerns about being strictly literal. Biblically literal.
Oh, great. I can't wait for those.
So it's... It's nice, though. Like,
Oh, yeah, so I'm not arguing with you, Elijah. I'm sure it's going to be amazing, but this is basically like Noah and Exodus all over again.
But it's not, though. Like, I don't think people are going to be as angry about it.
You don't think so?
No, because it's not taking a story that you know and messing it up. It's taking a... So it takes
place... Taking a story you don't know and messing it up.
Yeah.
It's a completely created story. So, like, it's a... It's as Jesus is leaving the wilderness after being tempted, and he interacts with his family. And so it's actually a little gap in the biblical narrative with this imagined story about it's about Jesus and about it's great. So you'll enjoy that.
Hey,
so,
I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to add or take away anything from the Bible.
Yeah, so, probably not.
Actually, that's just from the book of Revelation, but proceed.
Oh, I don't think so, because that's not the way I choose to interpret it. So... Anyway, hopefully that won't happen, and I hope it'll be as good. I wanted to see that one ever since you did on it last year too, and I kept thinking I was going to get to see it sometime last summer, but no.
Well, it took forever to get a distributor, so it's real good that they finally did. Broadgreen. Broadgreen's doing good stuff.
Oh, I thought it would have been the Whatever Brothers that do all the Christian movies.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lie. They would have not done that. No.
The Koch Brothers? Koch? How do you say them?
Just like that.
Yeah.
Yep. That's what I thought.
Yep, definitely. definitely don't have to edit that part out. Pretty happy about
it's
that.
It's K-O-C-H. How else would you pronounce it?
Right.
That's phonetics, guys. That's phonetics.
Oh, all right. So, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can follow the show at Real World Theo. There's lots. You can find our website. We'll have show notes. We'll have ways to get in touch with these guys. And please do, because it is so wonderful to have these conversations. And if you can follow the work that they're doing, you're just going to have even more great conversations, because Elijah and JR are doing awesome things with their time and through their jobs. So please interact with them. Tell them how they're right, how they're wrong, et cetera, et cetera. They appreciate all those things.
I love being told I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Bring it.
JR really does. This wouldn't be possible without you, the listeners. So thank you so much for taking the time to make a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
That was awesome.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
There is almost always a method Or, yeah. You know, there are times, though, JR, that sometimes it's availability and having seen the movie.
And I don't have a real job, so pretty available.
Oh, so typically you are willing to see just about anything, even a movie as terrible as The Good Dinosaur, you know?
Or The Forest.
No!
Or
The Forest. Not a terrible movie.
That was an abomination.
It was awful.
It was not awful. You're kidding. No, it was totally
awful. Oh, I know what happened, Elijah. You know that was a 2.5 hour movie, right? You didn't fall asleep. It wasn't 15 minutes long. You fell asleep in the middle of it.
I enjoyed watching The Good Dinosaur more than Inside Out.
No!
I totally did.
This podcast just got... It's got
did you not room. Even watch Inside Out? Is that what happened?
I saw Inside Out 3 times.
Did you watch it with a friend who had a terminal illness? I don't understand. I don't understand what you just said.
But I totally understand people not...